for Films with Frost, Terry Frost.
I always love our Thursday evening because this man is here. Good evening, Terry Frost.
Good evening, Ivor Cole.
And how are you, man?
Doing great. Enjoying the movies, enjoying life in general.
This film tonight, that is all about enjoying life in general, really.
I think it's about greed, but it is a pretty enjoyable movie.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yes. It's a mad, 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 mad world from 1963.
Yeah, 63. When you actually look at the movie, it doesn't scream 63 somehow. It seems a little later because we're so used to the, I don't know, the Monty Python-esque thing that happens in it.
Yeah, and it's a really kind of a road trip sort of a movie. The basic plot line is that a group of people see a guy charging through the desert in a car. The car crashes and all the people in the following car stop and go down to rescue him. And he turns out to be a criminal called Smiler Grogan, played by Jimmy Durante. And he knows he's dying and he tells everybody who comes down to help him that he has planted some stolen money, $350,000 worth, underneath a big W in a certain park a number of hundred miles away. And slowly the people who find him sneak away to try to grab the money before everybody else does. And more people find out about it, more and more people get involved in the chase, and things start happening.
It's interesting because Smiler Grogan, Jimmy Durante, it was his last film role, wasn't it?
It was. It was soon after he did Dumbo. He did Dumbo with Doris Day and Stephen Boyd.
Yeah.
And it was his last film role. And he literally, well, we probably should play the audio to show what Smiler Grogan does.
Is he kidding?
Now, just hold on, mister. We're going to get you to hospital.
You move me, I'll break up in little pieces. But what a deal. Look, there's this dough, see? There's all this dough. 350 G's. Do you hear what I'm saying? 350 G's in the park in Rosita. Rosita Beach State Park. Just south of Dago in Santa Rosita. It's in this box. Buried under this... buried under this big W. You'll see it. You'll see it under this... under this big W. You can't miss it. A big W. And it's been there, and it's been laying there for 15 years.
He may die.
Listen, I tell you, I'm giving it to you. And don't let him kid you. Don't let him kid you. Don't let him give you the business, see? Because it was mine. And I paid for it. Paid for every lousy buck of it, you hear? But watch out. Watch out for the bulls. Lousy, stinking bulls are everywhere. Bulls all over the place. You just drive down and dig it up. Dig it all up. And then you fix yourselves all up. Fix yourselves all up. Walk down the street like a king. Back to the old neighborhood. See the fellas. The dames. The dames all with a big hello. Big hello for old Smiler. Good old Smiler. Everybody's friend.
That's the bit where he literally kicks the bucket.
Yeah, he literally right does kick the bucket, you know.
He kicks the bucket down the hill. It's a beautiful visual pun and always gets a laugh when I watch it with people. And the cast in this film is tremendous. They've got enormous amounts of actors. I'll just kind of go down a bit of the list. Spencer Tracy, normally known as a dramatic actor, does a good comedy role in this one. Milton Berle, Sid Caesar, Jonathan Winters, Mickey Rooney, Buddy Hackett, Buster Keaton, Jimmy Durante, Terry Thomas, Phil Silvers, Dick Shawn, Ethel Merman, Peter Falk's in it. You just go through this movie and everybody you see on the screen, you go, hey, I know that guy from somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a girl in it that in 1963, I thought she was quite the bee's knees, and that's Dorothy Provine.
Yeah, Dorothy Provine was fantastic. She did a TV series in the late 50s called The Roaring 20s.
Yeah, that's right. I used to love that show.
And she actually did a spy movie that I kind of like called Kiss the Girls and Make Them Die, and she looked really stunning in that movie as well. That was a couple of years after this film. It's a kind of Euro spy movie.
I don't know how many the actual cast list is, but you named about, I don't know, about 20. goodness me, the supporting actors. You keep spotting people, don't you, going, hey, that's that guy from so-and-so that went on, and you know that he's just had a bit part in this, but... Oh,
I mean, there's one scene where Jerry Lewis drives a car deliberately over Spencer Tracy's hat, and that's the only time you see Jerry Lewis in this movie.
Yes, that's right.
Basically, the movie is tons of stuff gets busted up.
Yeah, that's right. Do you think that they got all the actors because everybody wanted to work with Stanley Kramer, the director?
Well, Stanley Kramer had this great reputation as a kind of dramatic director and producer. Just before this, I'll go through the films he did immediately before he did It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. He did On the Beach, which was filmed here in Melbourne. Not an upbeat movie at all. No. Everybody in the world dies at the end of it.
That's right.
He did Inherit the Wind, which was a drama he did with Spencer Tracy in it about the Scopes monkey trial and teaching evolution in schools kind of thing. That's quite a dramatic piece.
Yeah.
And he did Judgment at Nuremberg about the Nuremberg trials after World War II. And it was all about Nazi persecution of people.
Yeah.
So they're the three movies he did immediately before this. And he jumps from those very serious and quite worthy films. They're all good movies. Directly onto this slapstick comedy thing where people do all sorts of things. Cars are smashing everywhere. People praying airplanes through billboards. Literally, a two-engine Beechcraft Baron went straight through a billboard in this movie.
And that would have been real, wouldn't it?
It was real. They were supposed to make a paper billboard for it, but the people who made it out of linen for some reason, and they damaged the leading edges of both wings on the plane. It could very easily have crashed doing that stunt.
Wow.
And there are a lot of spectacular stunts in this film. There's a scene where Jonathan Winters basically demolishes an entire petrol station. And there are things falling on people and they're bashing through walls and all sorts of things, even though you know, of course, that there's going to be balsa wood and bits of plaster and things like that. There's still some very physical and very dangerous stunts in this film.
Yeah, it's true. And look, you know, another guy that's in it that I love because he's the voice of Mr. Magoo is Jim Backus.
Jim Backus playing the drunken pilot.
Yes.
He's hilarious. Yeah, he tells them to hold on to the wheel. He'll go back and make a couple of old-fashioned for everybody in the back of the plane.
That's right. Oh, dear. Oh, look, I can't recommend this movie highly enough. It is a real romp. And if you want to get out of your mind for 2 hours or something, isn't it?
It's a very long movie. Yeah. It actually has an intermission in the middle of it. That's how long. Back when they had big movies like Lawrence of Arabia and Camelot and all these other films, they'd have an intermission there. Everyone would go and get their popcorn, have a smoke, come back in and watch the rest of the movie. And this one has an intermission. It was actually filmed in Cinerama, which was this weird film process where they had a big curved screen in front of the audience. And it was almost like a wraparound film experience. Originally, the Cinerama film things had three separate projectors overlapping each other slightly. But by the time It's a Mad, 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 Mad World came out, they had a thing called Ultra Panavision 70, where they did it all on one film strip. But still, it was originally done for this enormously wide curved screen in front of the audience. There was even a Russian version of it called Kino Panorama.
Right.
So the Russians even had a go at doing this kind of thing for their film studios. And it was really, the screens were very, very unusually made because they were made of little vertical strips about 7/8 of an inch wide. And each little strip making up this enormous screen was aimed directly at the audience. They were all tilted slightly so they came face onto the audience. Yeah, there's actually a couple of surviving Cinerama cinemas around the world. There's one around San Francisco, I think, or Seattle, that Paul Allen, one of the Microsoft billionaires, rescued. And every year they have a Cinerama festival and show all the Cinerama movies at this surviving cinema.
How many surviving movies, I wonder?
There weren't all that many made. There were only about 20 or so made of various kinds. A lot of them were kind of documentaries just to show off the film process. But there were movies like The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm, and this one, and How the West Was Won, which were all made in this enormously wide film stock. They've actually got a version of it that's out on Blu-ray now of one of those films, which you can actually project onto a curved screen if you choose to do it.
Well, that's what I saw, How the West Was Won, I saw in Cinerama.
I think I might have as well. There was a cinema in Sydney, I think the Embassy or one of those kind of cinemas in Sydney had a Cinerama screen. And I'm sure I've seen at least one with those slightly overlapping screens on it.
This film, did it cost billions of dollars? Because, I mean, the cast, as we've said, the names that you named were all headliners. So how much did this film cost to make, for goodness sake?
It was quite expensive at the time, $9.4 million, which doesn't sound like much in 2012. But at the time, it was a very, very big budget film. And, of course, they had to pay for all these groovy actors to be in there. But the good part of it is that they made back $46 million.
That's good for the day, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was a big spectacle. It was one of those things where it had this weird film process of Cinerama that was very kind of popular at the time and was getting a lot of publicity as well. They had tons and tons of people that people knew from television and other films in it. And it had things people hadn't seen before, which was incredibly dangerous action stunts done for laughs. I mean, there were silent comedies where that occurred, but it hasn't been stripped together the way these ones are. One punchline after the other, one physical gag and crazy stunt bit after the other. They really hadn't done that before, and this film kind of cemented that as a very popular kind of slapstick approach to things.
Which is still happening today.
Yeah, in fact, there's a movie called Rat Race or something like that recently with Rowan Atkinson and John Cleese only a few years ago, which is basically the same plot, stolen and adapted for the 21st century.
Let's get a bit more into the plot, because every man and his dog, as they say, is after this money. But there's also Spencer Tracy's character, the copper, that's been trying to crack this robbery for like 10 years or something.
Yeah, I mean, Spencer Tracy is funny in this, because when you see him right at the start, and this is a movie in-joke, when you see him right at the start, he's got one hand tucked into his pocket. He's wearing a black suit and a black hat, and he looks exactly the same way he did in Bad Day at Black Rock, where he was playing a guy with a crippled hand. And then he takes his hand out of the pocket and plays with his hat. So
right.
It kind of breaks that. But it's kind of one of those little visual references to an earlier movie. And he is funny in this. I mean, he's kind of the straight guy to all these comedians, in a sense. He's got you hear his wife and his daughter on the phone. He's got a daughter who's 6.5 foot tall and can't find a boyfriend.
Yes.
He's got a nagging wife. He's got a boss who's is trying to get his pension up because he's coming up to retirement age. And you've got all this chaos as well as these mad people all trying to get this $350,000. It's kind of like a satire on American greed, in a sense. Normal people are corrupted by this money. You got Jonathan Winters playing Lenny, the truck driver who's driving a load of furniture across the country. And you got Phil Silvers as a con man, of course.
Yeah.
And you've got Sid Caesar playing a character who spent all his money trying to start a business making edible seaweed. And all of these various people who are kind of caricatures in a sense, but are reasonable, you know, everyday kind of people. A few problems. Ethel Merman playing his mother-in-law is a bit of a nightmare. But, they've got crazy people in there playing it straight and then slowly being drawn into their comic personas from these kind of relatively straight characters at the start until everybody's half insane, greedy, willing to almost kill everybody else to get the money, and in general, not acting the way that grown-ups should.
Listen, should we have another little bit of the movie?
Yeah, we'll have a little bit here, which is Terry Thomas, who gets involved along the way, having a little bit of a rant about the nature of the American psyche.
I must say, if I had the grievous misfortune to be a citizen of this benighted country, I should be the most hesitant in offering any criticism whatever of any other.
Wait a minute, are you knocking this country? Are you saying something against America?
Against it? I should be positively astounded to hear of anything that could be said for it. Why, the whole bloody place is the most unspeakable matriarchy in the whole history of civilization. Look at yourself and the way your wife and her strumpet of a mother push you through the hoop. As far as I can see, American men have been totally emasculated. They're like slaves. They die like flies from coronary thrombosis while their women sit under hair dryers eating chocolates and arranging for every second Tuesday to be some sort of Mother's Day. And this positively infantile preoccupation with bosoms. In all my time in this wretched, godforsaken country, the one thing that has appalled me most of all is this preposterous preoccupation with bosoms. Don't you realize that they've become the dominant theme in American culture? In literature, advertising, in all fields of entertainment, in everything. I'll wager you anything you like, if American women stopped wearing brassieres, your whole national economy would collapse overnight.
Okay, for the people who don't know who Terry Thomas is, maybe you should tell us.
Yeah, he was a British comedian. He started out doing things like a few of the Carry On movies and a number of other comedies. He always played a kind of retired, very slightly slimy English officer of some kind with a mustache and a gap in his teeth and that kind of cut glass accent, who, you know, he is kind of very lecherous character, very greedy character, very cowardly character, and he kind of made that sort of role his own. And he did any number of these films. Unfortunately, towards the end of his life, he had quite an unfortunate end. He got Parkinson's disease and was quite broke at the end. But people remember him from these films. And even though he's a character you would not let anywhere near you in real life, he kind of drew the audience along and really staked a claim to a certain type of character in comedy films.
Yeah, he sure did. He often wore a monocle as well.
A monocle and usually some kind of silly hat.
Yes.
And a cravat, often a cravat.
Yes, often a cravat. Yeah, that's right. Well, look, they're after the money and it's buried under a big W. Now, we don't want to give this away, do we? Because in the film, they suddenly discover the big W, and it's nothing to do with a major store that we're talking about in Australia today.
No, it isn't. It's something else entirely. And it's really great that how a number of other characters kind of get involved. There's Seymour, who's the son of the Ethel Merman character. And we first see him singing and dancing with his girlfriend, played by an actress called Barry Chase, to a Shirelles song, 31 Flavors. And that's a crazy little dance scene. He's got this bachelor pad on the beach with a giant tiki statue in it and all this other really cool stuff in it, just kind of doing this crazy dance with his girlfriend, whom he then ignores totally.
That's right.
She's reclined on the bed in a black bikini and he totally ignores her. And you think, what is this guy about?
And you never find out.
No, I think he may have what's now known as issues.
Yes, that's right. You see, the funny thing is that when you said last week we were going to do this, I said, you know, some of it doesn't make sense. And some of it doesn't make sense. It is a lot of sight gags that are just, you know, just make you laugh. But then, you know, they take you away from the actual plot quite often because and then you go, oh, yeah, that's what's happening because you get so involved with the sight gags.
You do, and the thing is that it can divert you. And if it works really well and you don't quite notice it till after you've watched the film, I think it really is effective. And they've also got a great climax right on the point where they have the intermission in the movie. A whole bunch of things come to a climax. They build you up and then have an intermission. So you're really kind of tense. What's going to happen to the people locked in the hardware store with the explosives? What's going to happen to this person? What's going to happen to that person? And then they bring you back from the intermission and let the rest of the story reveal itself.
Yeah.
I think that's really nice plotting when they bring a whole bunch of those threads together right at one point of the movie.
Well, you know, this actually does have, that's called a cliffhanger, of course, isn't it?
Mm,
and this does have the equivalent of a cliffhanger at the end, actually. We won't go into that.
Well, it does have a lot of people hanging.
It sure does.
In various ways.
And it's a glorious finish. It's a glorious way to end the movie, I think, anyway.
And it's got one little bit right at the very end where they use the oldest gag in history to give you that last cathartic laugh in the movie too.
Yes, that's right. Look, I wish we could say it, but we can't, can we?
No, I think people should find it. You can find this movie pretty readily around the place. It is available quite widely. And if you saw it years ago on TV or something like that, I really think that people should revisit it. It is quite long. It's about 2 hours and 30 minutes. But the time just flies with this film. You're not slowed down at all by it. You don't get distracted from it. It's just, you look at the stunts and you realise that there's no CGI in any of these stunts. And people are actually doing all of these crazy things that you see on the screen. And it gives you a kind of respect and it gives it kind of a street cred that modern CGI movies don't have. You think, these stunt people were driving that car down that enormously steep mountain trail. And it's not just any car. It's an enormous 1950s-style American convertible.
Yeah.
You know, 2 tons of metal.
Yeah.
Going down a rocky, bumpy road. And a lot of the stunts when they were kind of winding around mountain roads and things like that, and those American cars of the time. And you just got to admire this car stunts, let alone anything else in the film.
Yeah, that's true, because the suspension on those was notoriously soft and squishy. And I don't think in those days they would have rigged them up like they do today. So that would have been like just a car and you get in it and drive it.
Yeah, and there's a bit where there's a truck full of furniture, an open flatbed truck full of furniture going down a mountain slope, and there is somebody behind the wheel driving the silly thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, all credit to them for doing it. I think that, you know, I mean, they would have had to have ambulances ready for that sort of thing. And they got the shots. They made them work in the context of the film. And this movie is just, if you ever watch those TV shows that are about disasters happening, this is a comedy movie that does all of that stuff all in one big go.
We can say one. No, we can't really. Yeah, I was just going to mention that.
Give him one spoiler.
Well, Culpepper, he turns, let's say.
Yeah, the copper turns a little bit, but The lovely thing about it is that he turns after enormous provocation. It's not just one of those greed things for him.
No.
You can almost see him sitting there at his desk, having a mental breakdown and then deciding, I'm fed up with this, I'm fed up with dealing with bureaucracy, I'm fed up with dealing with my family, I'm particularly fed up with dealing with these idiots who are almost killing themselves with this money. So I'm going to take action. I think a lot of this is the start of the disillusion of America with the American dream, as it's called. They show these people being incredibly greedy and letting the money corrupt them. You see just what it does to people, of course, in a very exaggerated and very funny way. But it's that kind of start of the people going, yeah, is this American dream really what we want? Or do we want to have something else for our lives? And Stanley Kramer was always about issues in the movies he made. And I think he slipped a little bit of philosophy under the radar in this film in a very interesting way.
Yeah, well, that's what you were saying last week, that you can watch a movie and just watch a movie, or you can actually watch it and pick up on certain things that are laid in there for you in layers, as you said. And if you want to, you can pick them up, and if you don't, it doesn't really matter. It's still a good movie. The music is really interesting in this movie too, actually.
Yeah, it's got a really kind of rollicking... The title sequence is very good too. It was done by a guy called Saul Bass, who did a lot of animation. And the music by Ernest Gold, it's kind of got that carnival lilt to it. It's almost like music you would hear at a carnival or a circus.
Yeah.
It's got that penny whistle kind of melody thing about it, which is really good. And the title set you up. They got a comedy title thing, which is a little bit like the old Pink Panther cartoons, a lot of which were done by people like Saul Bass and Fritz Freleng and people like that. And it really does set you up for, you know, sit back, eat your popcorn, have a good time. This movie is not anything to take seriously, even though it's got a little tiny bit of a message hidden in there if you want it. But it's basically about lots of silly things happening, portrayed by people that you already know from other places, all getting together and just making something incredibly silly. And silly sometimes is just what people need.
That's right. Well, look, even Peter Falk's excellent in this. And this was well before his Columbo days, of course.
Yeah, I mean, my favourite Peter Falk thing is him in Robin and the Seven Hoods with the Rat Pack and Sinatra, yes, and those guys. He actually gets to sing a song. Yeah. Peter Falk singing a song is fantastic to see. People should look it up on one of those video sites and really see what they can find there. But, I've got a lot of time for Peter Falk. You also did movies like Wings of Desire.
That's
so
right.
He did some really serious roles later on. And this one, he's a bit of fun. He's in there with the ensemble, and they're all just having a great time, not taking it seriously, and putting together something which I don't think there's any other film quite like it, for the sheer amount of comedy actors they put together, the madness of the stunts, the energy of the plot, and there is a plot in there and as it's drawn along, and just the people and the places and the fact that they do pace it incredibly well.
Yeah, you're dead right. I'm glad you reawakened this movie in my eyes, because I hadn't actually seen it for, oh, God knows how long. It must be 30 years, maybe more, actually. I was shocked at how well it actually stood up.
It very much does. I mean, people are used to seeing, you know, the CGI, the summer blockbuster kind of things and stuff like that. And it's good to see that people could do that before they had computer technology to do it. I mean, I've got tons of times for a lot of these movies that do use that sort of thing. But I think that they're educated by these older films that were done real life, and they decided, okay, we don't want it to be quite as dangerous, we want to save some money, we'll do it by other means. But it is good to go back to the original films where these kind of crazy action stunt scenes are done, and to just enjoy them the same way we would enjoy those modern blockbuster films. And I think you can do that with this movie.
That's right. And look, you know, there are so many fabulous little cameos. I don't know how many actors pop in them, but I mean, gee whiz, I know that Stan Freberg is in there, and I've always had a soft spot for him because he made some brilliant comedy records in the late 50s and early 60s.
Buster Keaton's in there for about a minute and a half towards the end as well.
Yeah, Buster Keaton, you know, he made quite a lot of films very, very late in his life, and often without speaking.
Yeah, he did A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, for instance. He did a few of those beach party movies with Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello. I think he did at least one of those and a bunch of other things. He was an interesting guy. He did have a problem with alcohol at some stage in his life, but he got his act together towards the end there. And he did all these little roles in comedy films. And just with that kind of long face of his and his skill at being a silent movie actor, he could bring things across and bring things to a movie that other people really just didn't have the chops to do.
Yeah, because he did, as we like to say in Australia, he'd put in the hard yards.
Yep, he paid his dues.
He sure did. Well, there's another one to spot, I reckon, and that's Carl Reiner. He's the airport flight controller.
Yeah, the air traffic controller in there. And he has a lot of fun too. He was at that stage on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Oh. And, of course, his son Rob Reiner did Spinal Tap. So all kudos to that family.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I said, thank you so much for this movie, man. I think it's a blast. And I wish it was an ABC product because I'd love to have a copy to give away.
It would be fantastic to do that. But maybe people can give it to each other as gifts.
Yeah, look, if anybody's birthday's coming up and you know they've got a sense of humour, they'll love this, won't they?
That we will love it indeed.
Perfect. Do you know what we're doing next week, mister?
I do. I thought we'd go back to film noir. We get you back into that area. And we'll do a movie that I know that we both like called The Bribe. Robert Taylor, Ava Gardner, Charles Laughton, Vincent Price. Very little known film noir, which does turn up on ABC 2 very occasionally.
Well, actually, you are the person that turned me onto this film.
Yeah, it's a great forgotten film noir. People should put it on their list. It's got some great ensemble acting.
Cool, man. Thank you for tonight, Terry.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks a lot, Iowa.
See you, mate.
See you, mate.
Chill out for Films with Frost. Terry Frost.
I almost can't wait till next Thursday, but I'm afraid we all have to. That's when Terry Frost will be back with us. You're on ABC Local Radio right across the territory. This is After Dark, and I'm Ivor Cole.